Welcome back to the What's Cooking podcast with me, Beth, and my co-host, Kat. We talk to food and drink entrepreneurs about their businesses, how they got started, and what gets them out of bed in the morning.
Today we're here with Adam, co-founder of Jar Kombucha. Adam founded Jar in 2015 to bring kombucha, a raw fermented tea full of nutrients, into the mainstream market in the UK. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having
me. Hello. Hey. Okay, to start off, what was your first ever job in food or food and drink?
Oh man, in food and drink. Well, I first moved to London in 2011, and I was a breakfast cook, at one point kitchen manager, at a cafe in Hackney Wick called The Counter, which was run by my now business partners, Tom and Jess Seaton. So I was cooking breakfasts, and that's about it for about 2 years before I left London for a little while, went traveling, moved back to LA, and then I came back again in 2015 to start Jar. So yeah, that's how I got started in the food industry.
Cool. And did you know them already, or did you meet them through working?
I knew
at
them
the
already.
Counter?
I had met them through my best friend Dom, who's from New Zealand, and Dom had grown up across the street from Tom and Jess. And they had moved to London like maybe 12 years ago or something like that and started this cafe. And I moved over to London because Dom was like, you know, we're all living in warehouses, we're having these amazing parties, we all work in the cafe. And it was kind of this like fairy tale story. And I came to visit before I moved and I was blown away by like the creativity and the connection and all the different things that were happening in Hackney Wick at the time, which is one of the reasons why that's where Jar was born, because it's historically, for me and for a lot of people, been the space of creativity and innovation and openness and freedom. So, yeah, that's kind of my experience with that.
That's cool.
Tell us about when you first came across kombucha.
I was introduced to kombucha around 2008 while at university in San Diego. And I was introduced through my best friend, Allison, who is very much into yoga and wellness. And I remember trying it for the first time. It was a GT's Synergy Mango. I think it was called Mystic Mango. And I was like, what the hell is Mystic Mango? And I tried it, and I was like, nah, not into this. It's like, it's vinegar with like a little bit of mango juice in it. But then I started seeing it pop up in more and more places. I would see it at the yoga studio. I would see it at Whole Foods. I would see it like at cafes. And around that time, kombucha was becoming more and more popular in Southern California. And so I just kept at it, and I started trying different brands, different flavors, and slowly my palate started to change, and one day it just clicked, and suddenly no kombucha was vinegary enough. So I've been a big fan of kombucha probably since 2009, and been drinking it regularly, spending too much money on it. But it wasn't until 2015 that I actually learned how to make it, and then came up with the idea for Jar.
Cool. So tell us about that, about the when the idea formed for Jar.
Okay. So it's sort of a long story, but I like telling it because it gives you context into how random it is that we started making kombucha.
Yeah.
So I mentioned that I'd lived in London previously, and then after 2 years I went traveling and then moved back in with my parents because I was broke after a year of backpacking. And I was 27, I was trying to figure out what to do with my life. I was working in my dad's office as a receptionist and also as like a music therapist for children with disabilities. But I wanted to leave LA, so my sister, a spare room opened up in her apartment in San Francisco. So she's like, you should move in with me and find a job up north. So I packed a van full of stuff and I left my parents' house and I got halfway from LA to San Francisco, like 4 hours into the drive, and I got a call from my mom. And she's like, your sister's apartment has burned down. She was out on a run. She came back. The whole place was gone. Like, it was totally destroyed. She lost everything. And no one was hurt, thankfully, but I had nowhere to stay. She had nowhere to stay. It was this huge kind of thing. So my mom's like, you need to turn around and drive back to LA. So that's what I did, reluctantly. Moved back in with my parents. And about a week after I'd moved back in, I got a message from my friends and now business partners in Jar, saying we have a layover in Los Angeles on our way back from New Zealand and Australia to London. So they run a craft beer brewery called Crate in London. And they were traveling to New Zealand where they're from. And while they were in Auckland, they'd been introduced to kombucha. And so when they came to visit me and I opened up the fridge and I had loads of kombucha in the fridge, they were like, no way, we just found out about this stuff. We love this. So I pulled some out, we were drinking it, we were sitting around my parents' kitchen table talking about kombucha. And my friend Jess was like, what are you doing with your life? She's like, you don't have a place to live now. You don't have a job. You're living with your parents. She's like, how about we learn how to make kombucha and you move back to London? And we start a kombucha brewery. And I was like, you know what? That's not a bad idea. And 2 weeks later, I booked a flight to London. 2 months after that, I was in London. We were experimenting on our first batches. And the idea for Jar was born. So it was because of that house fire in San Francisco that this happened. So a random series of events that brought me to where I am now. Pretty random.
I just love that you decided to go for it before you'd even tried making kombucha.
I had no idea how it was made.
Yeah.
I knew that it was fermented tea, but
yeah.
I'd never made it before. I'd never seen anyone make it. So I was like, wait, I just agreed to something that I don't
you
even really know anything about.
Yeah, obviously felt right.
Exactly.
And the connection you had with those people as well. Mm-hmm.
For sure. I think you know intuitively when something feels right. So kombucha was something I loved. These people were people that I loved. And they already had a background in brewing, beer brewing. So I was confident that we'd be able to figure it out. But literally the first thing that I did was I went on Google and I was like, how to make kombucha? And there were very few YouTube videos at that time about it. But I found this woman teaching workshops out of her kitchen in Venice Beach. So I signed up with her. Her name was Hannah Crum, and her pseudonym is the Kombucha Mama. she's actually now the leading expert on kombucha fermentation internationally.
Wow.
And she runs this organization called Kombucha Brewers International. And they run KombuchaCon every year, which is like this convention for kombucha brewers. But at the time, she was just teaching these groups of four or five people out of her kitchen. So I went to her house, got my first SCOBY, got my first tea and jar, and then started experimenting while my friends and business partners started experimenting in London. So we sort of combined forces, and then I moved over and we experimented again for 6 months and then kind of refined our recipe. But it took a long time to figure it out. Kombucha is not necessarily the easiest thing to make consistently.
Yeah, should we talk about what goes into kombucha?
Yeah.
What it is?
So in a very basic sense, kombucha is fermented tea. Kind of the classical version of kombucha, or in its simplest form, it's made from tea, water, sugar, and a SCOBY, which is a symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. And these ingredients are kind of brewed together and left in a warm environment for around 2 weeks, eventually leaving you with like this nutrient-dense, kind of sour, sweet, soft drink that's really good for you. So that's sort of how it's made, but there's so many different versions of it. There's so many different varieties of tea, and no kombucha tastes the same because everyone's doing it slightly differently, which is kind of the beauty of it. Similar to beer, actually.
Yeah. So is that what you were playing around with? Different types of tea, different types of sugar, different like lengths of time of fermentation and things like that?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. We tried dozens of different types of tea before settling on this blend of green and oolong tea. The way we found our tea is our head brewer and my best friend, Dom. He was managing a cafe called Pavilion in Hackney. Do you know Pavilion?
Yeah, I actually was at the one in Cornwall just last weekend.
Oh, nice. I haven't been to that one.
It's beautiful, yeah. And they've just started doing dinner. It's lovely.
Nice.
Yeah.
So one of the owner's name is Rob. One of his best friends, his name is Chella. And his family has owned tea plantations in Sri Lanka for like, I don't know, his whole life. And he inherited these tea plantations from his family. And so through Rob, we met Chella, and turns out he had the perfect green tea. So we sourced directly from his tea estate. So that was how we first got our green tea, and then the oolong tea we started sourcing from China. So it's funny how all these weird connections just, you know, show up in some way, and then, you know, they make sense.
Yeah, nice to kind of keep it all within your network as well. That's really cool.
Yeah.
And once you felt like you'd kind of figured it out and perfected your process, what was your first step towards actually starting to get it out there to customers?
Well, before we launched in bottle, we opened a kombucha tap room called Jar Bar, which was inside our warehouse, which is called Mix Garage in Hackney Wick. And we were like, this is going to be great. Like, we're opening the first kombucha tap room in Europe. People are going to love it. And, like, no one showed up except our friends. Nobody knew what kombucha was. But we started selling it in cocktails, which people started drinking. a lot of the time they didn't even know kombucha was in there, but it was sort of our way to sort of push it out there. And then we started serving beer and cider on draft and wine. And then Berberine Q. Do you know that restaurant?
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
So good.
Yeah.
They opened a pop-up inside our warehouse called Shook Shook. So that would bring people in. We would do kombucha on tap, kombucha cocktails. And it was sort of like a kind of like a low-key beer hall type vibe. And we'd have DJs. But eventually, more and more people started becoming interested in the actual music side of things, and we realized that kombucha was no longer the main feature. So we sort of took out the tap room and morphed that into a nightclub, which is now quite a well-known warehouse party destination in East London. So what used to be Jar Bar is now just Mixed Garage, which is this nightclub.
Okay.
And we're hopefully next year at some point going to reimagine the kombucha tap room. So I think people are sort of ready for it now and have a microbrewery and offer kombucha on tap. But initially, it was a way for us to get feedback from people. So we would bring friends in, we'd bring random people in. Time Out came in and reviewed our kombucha and actually reviewed it and said that it was horrible and it tasted like gone-off vinegar. So at that point, we knew we needed to refine our recipe. And that's sort of how we came up with our different flavors from trial and error and getting feedback directly from customers. So that was our first foray into introducing the brews to people. And then after about 6 months, we settled on the three flavors and then launched them in bottle.
How do you go, you know, we were talking before we started, you can start in a jar with SCOBY. How do you go from small scale to much, much bigger scale? Like, what kind of equipment did you have to buy in, specialist stuff? Did you already have it with your friends from Crate Brewery?
We didn't have any of the equipment, but we sort of had an idea of what we needed.
Okay.
But it was really trial and error. It was like we started out in small glass jars, and slowly but surely we grew enough SCOBY and enough starter liquid in order to make larger and larger batches. So we'd go from 1 liter to 4 liters, and then from 4 liters to 16 liters, and so on and so forth. So basically, if you leave your kombucha in a small kind of jar for a period of time, it becomes sour enough that you can scale up quite quickly.
Okay.
So eventually we were able to fill kind of a quarter of like a 1,000 liter tank, and then that would, you know, quadruple, and then so on and so forth. So we really had to slowly build up this this culture in order to have enough for it. But, you know, it ferments entirely differently in a large stainless steel kind of tank.
Oh, really?
As it would in a small glass jar. So we lost so many batches. We had so many kind of batches that went funky or went off, and it was a huge learning curve for us because it's a totally different beast when you're fermenting at that scale. So it took quite a long time.
Yeah, is it? You've just got more factors to control, like more variables that can sort of go different, like wrong. Or...
Yeah, definitely. And like the way that bacteria and yeast function at that scale is kind of different.
Okay.
They don't kind of get throughout the liquid as efficiently. You have a lot more CO2. You have a lot more, you know, more booch, mo problems. I don't know. But it took us a long time to figure out exactly how to make that work. And actually, we ferment slightly differently at that scale than you would normally on a small scale.
Okay.
But yeah, just trial and error. But a lot of the equipment that we use is similar to what you use in beer brewing. So, you know, hoses, pumps, stainless steel fermentation tanks. But eventually we realized that the tanks we initially bought were too tall and skinny. So we designed our own, which are a bit wider and allow more surface area, which is better for bacteria growth. So we sort of customized these tanks to optimize the brewing conditions for kombucha.
How did you find sort of the... when you started kind of approaching stockists,
mm-hmm.
at the point when you were doing it, how did you find that kind of education process? Because obviously that's another kind of obstacle, is the buyers and getting them to believe in this.
I think it wasn't as hard as you might think, actually, because kombucha was an industry that was incredibly successful in the States,
mm-hmm.
and we could quote numbers,
yeah.
That... a lot of the stockists here wanted to be the first movers. They wanted to have a kombucha. They wanted to have a London brewed kombucha. It also helped that we designed the bottles in a certain way. So our first stockist was Harrods. We were introduced to the buyer there randomly through our PR company. They're called Fraser Communications. And Marcus, who is one of the founders, connected us with Ben, who was the buyer at the time, and we were just so nervous. We're like, oh my God, we got to give him the best batch. And we went to the Harrods headquarters, and I was all dressed up, and I never dress up, and like, was like sweating, and like, he tasted it, and he's like, yeah, sweet, cool, we'll do it. And like, we didn't even have to sell it. We didn't even talk about price, like nothing.
Wow.
It was just like, wow. And that was huge. I mean, for the business, but also for me personally, because my family is Welsh on my mom's side, and we used to come to England for holidays every year for Christmas. And my parents would always take me and my sister to Harrods, and we'd have like tea and scones from the age of like 4. So Harrods for me was always this like magical place, and their food halls were just like grand and beautiful. So I remember the first time that my parents came to visit, and I took them into Harrods, and there was jar kombucha on the shelves. Like, my dad actually cried. And I've seen my dad cry like 5 times ever. And I was like, holy shit. And then I got emotional and I was like, man, this is amazing. So that was huge. You know, Whole Foods came on board and Planet Organic, and they were already clued up on what kombucha was. And we work with a wholesaler called Marigold, who's kind of the number one like natural food wholesaler in the UK, or I guess in London. And they signed us up. But I must give a shout out to Love Kombucha and Go Kombucha and Equinox, because they were there before us. They were doing it for a couple years before we came into the market. So they sort of paved the way here in the UK. And then we came in as the 4th brand. So, it was actually, we got really lucky with timing and where kombucha was at that point in time, and that we were one of the first brands. So, yeah.
Really cool.
I don't think it's always that easy, but...
I think it is, from what we've heard from other people, it's really hard being the first.
Mm.
So it is helpful if there's been a couple of brands to sort of help that education process and just open people up to it. What is this? And just so you understand. And then once you're kind of hooked, you do want to explore other brands and find out and taste different ones.
For sure.
But you've got to, it's getting that initial hook, which is quite difficult.
Yeah.
Can we talk a bit about your amazing packaging and branding? Because it's so different to other kombucha brands, and it's sort of minimalist and medicinal and just looks so different on the shelves. So what was that decision?
Well, we'd seen a lot of the brands in the States, and it was very colorful, very kind of health-based, very kind of flower of life. We always wanted to create a premium kombucha, a kombucha using premium quality ingredients that looked and felt very different. And thankfully, we were working with some incredible designers. But thankfully, we were working with these two incredible designers. Their name are Guy and Ella Jackson, and they run a studio called Dapple. And we were introduced to them through my business partner's cousin, who was their teacher at design school. And basically, they came on board from the beginning, and they helped us select the name, and they helped us kind of develop the brand identity. But we always, you know, sort of wanted something sort of Aesop-inspired, very toned back, very simple, very minimal. But something that you could see on the shelf and not know exactly what it was, but be like, wow, that's really interesting. Is that a shampoo? Is that like a essential oils? Is that a gin? Oh, no, it's a kombucha. And it's sort of... because kombucha was this new concept, we wanted to create a new identity that maybe people hadn't seen before. That was sort of the idea behind it. And also the bottle style sort of implies health without having to say it directly, that it has that kind of apothecary, that kind of old medicine feel to it. So we wanted to imply that without explicitly having to say it. Yeah.
I kind of feel like, how am I going to say it? It's sort of... with a product, when it's coming into market and it's kind of something new for consumers, I kind of feel like there's an element of when someone comes out with something that doesn't immediately scream what it is, you kind of know then that it's happening.
Yeah.
And it's because that kind of almost educates people in a different way about it. And as you say, they're like, oh, what is it? Oh, it's a kombucha. And it's less like overt, and you're kind of trusting the consumer to make their decision in a different way,
for sure.
Which is really cool.
We are noticing, though, like initially it was great, and it still is to a certain extent, because when you do see our bottle on shelf, it next to other kombuchas, it looks entirely different. It has its own space. But now that there's so many brands in the market, we have to distinguish ourselves as a kombucha. So we're working on a couple of little tweaks just to give people kind of a clearer idea of the fact that it's kombucha. And considering launching new formats, which will be a bit more colorful and a bit easier for people to pick up that are maybe not kind of inclined towards design. Because initially I think that appeals to quite a small number of people. And also they're super expensive. The bottles are not cheap. The screen printing instead of labeling is incredibly expensive. But you know, we love it, and I'm pretty stoked every time I pick one up and I'm like, this is nuts. Like, yeah, I'm still very happy whenever I get to drink, you know, a bottle of our own creation.
You don't see screen printing on glass very much.
Yeah, you normally see it in spirits or kind of really high-end, I don't know, products like shampoos or like lotions or stuff like that. So it was kind of a leap at the time, but I think it allows us to distinguish ourselves for sure.
Yeah.
I'm interested, you kind of mentioned the health benefits and that are health benefits to drinking kombucha. How is it, how much are you allowed to say on pack? And is there sort of restrictions around that, what you're allowed to say?
Well, what I understand is that you can't use the word probiotic in this country, whereas in the States, you can say basically anything you want. You can say, you know, kombucha cures you of cancer. I don't know if it's that, if you can literally say that. But it's different here than it is in the States. And also, I think that the general public is more discerning. They're not as willing to believe the hype. And kombucha is good for you, but it's not good for you for the reasons that most people think. Now, one of the reasons why we lead kombucha workshops is to educate people about how to make it, what it's all about, where it comes from, and also kind of the realistic health benefits, like why it actually is good for you. And number one is the fact that it's brewed with tea, so it contains antioxidants, especially if you're using something like green tea or oolong tea or black tea. And when you ferment kombucha, the antioxidant value actually goes up. That's because the cell walls of the tea plant basically break down, making the antioxidants inside more bioavailable. So it's really interesting to see that. We have some like studies on that and stuff that we quote occasionally. And in addition to that, you have acetic acid, which is what gives kombucha that kind of vinegary bite. And acetic acid is really good for balancing the pH in your gut. It's good for promoting the growth of good bacteria and killing bad bacteria. Among other things, it also helps you slow the release of insulin into your bloodstream when you've had like a high carb meal. So acetic acid is great, but you know, batch to batch, brand to brand, you don't exactly know how much acetic acid is in each brew, so it's difficult to quote that. The thing that's not scientifically proven are the bacteria that's found in kombucha. Now kombucha does contain bacteria, but strains of bacteria found in kombucha are not strains that naturally exist in your microbiome. So generally speaking, even if they did make their way through the acidic environment of your stomach, which would generally kill a lot of the bacteria, they're not going to propagate themselves from scratch. So we stay away from the discussion about probiotics because there's no scientific research to support that fact with regards to kombucha. But yeah, the tea, the acids are kind of the proven benefits, and that's sort of what we focus on. But the health angle is not necessarily something that we speak about too often. Mm-hmm. We're mainly just like, listen, this is like a low sugar, all natural kind of, you know, very simply brewed drink that is healthier for you than, say, you know, Coca-Cola or an artificially produced soft drink or something like that. And it's a great alternative to alcohol as well because it's so complex in its flavor profile that you can sort of have it and feel like you're drinking something a bit different from kind of a soda.
Yeah, I'm so happy that more sort of bars and pubs and places are taking it on as a drink because, yeah, the only other options to alcohol for so long were super sugary fizzy drinks.
Whereas it was now, like J2O or something.
Yeah.
Like, this is all you have.
Yeah, and like you said, it's not complex and you don't have that. It's got such a complex flavor profile.
Yeah, it's from
it's
the
satisfying.
Yeah.
Exactly. It has.
Yeah.
I think the experience of drinking alcohol is, of course, for most of us, about the feeling, but also the flavor, the mouthfeel, the social aspect of it. So if you have something that you can sip on rather than, you know, something that really has no body or complexity, something that is more like a beer or a cider, you're more likely to feel less uncomfortable about not drinking.
Mm.
So kombucha sort of fills that space quite nicely.
So you've been doing some collaborations with restaurants and brands and to make really interesting brews. Could we talk a little bit more about those?
Sure. I guess the coolest one that we've been partnering up with is an organization called Pour, which is run by a couple of well-known cocktail makers, Alex Cretina, Simone Caparelli, and Monica Sa. And they run this nonprofit organization that supports kind of the industry. They have a symposium every year, and they invited us a couple years ago to make a one-off kombucha for the symposium. And for that one, we made a hemp-based kombucha using organic hemp leaves from this organic hemp collective called Hempen, which is in Oxford. And actually, since then, we've made that into an on-draft kombucha that's now stocked at this place called Taylor Elementary, which is in Old Street, and it's run by Alex and Monica. It's this, like, incredible bar. And they have our hemp kombucha on tap, which is really cool. We've also done a guayusa kombucha, which is made from guayusa, which is an Amazonian holly tree that has been used in tribal cultures for like 5,000 years. And it contains theobromine, which is commonly found in dark chocolate, and loads of caffeine, as well as theanine. So it's this kind of energizing but also relaxing effect, and it contains loads of antioxidants. And when you ferment it, the flavor you get is unreal. And then for the Pour Symposium this year, which is in 2 weeks, we've made a fig leaf kombucha that we have basically secondary fermented with champagne yeast to bring the alcohol percentage up to 12 to 14%. So it's like a really complex kind of wine-like kombucha that will get you drunk if you drink it out of it. But yeah, experimenting constantly is something that we're always doing. I recently just made a Douglas fir kombucha for our buddy. His name's Douglas McMaster, and he runs Silo, which is actually moving to Hackney Wick.
Yes, I can't wait.
Which is going to be super cool.
Yeah.
Doug was looking for a new space because his lease was running out in Brighton, and I was like, well, Crate Brewery, like the bar upstairs, like basically they have this huge space, and they're looking to partner with somebody, and I gave him a tour, and turns out they clicked, and now he's putting Silo in a Crate. So we're going to do some interesting stuff with him, and with Silo to kind of like offer kombucha on tap and stuff using seasonal ingredients.
Sounds amazing.
Have you had any blends that have really
gone
sour?
Bad.
Yeah.
Or
explosions.
We've had definitely some exploding bottles, and but that's a matter of kind of leaving it in the heat for too long with too much fruit juice.
Mm-hmm.
We've experimented a lot with coffee kombucha, and that's something we're still trying to crack. I just got a message from Hugh from Sandow's yesterday saying, dude, when are we going to do this coffee kombucha? So we're still experimenting with that, but we haven't found the flavor profile that suits it quite yet, so we're still messing around. We haven't had anything that's too horrible, to be honest, so, and if we did, we wouldn't really share it with anyone. But, thankfully, kombucha works well with
it
so
many different
things.
It takes on a lot
things.
Of flavors, yeah.
Totally, and you can make kombucha with not just tea, you can make it with anything that you can pick, and you can steep. So flowers, leaves, like fruit, you can literally, anything you can steep in hot water, you can ferment for a period of time and turn it into kombucha. And that's sort of the beauty of it. It doesn't have to be tea. It can be literally anything, which is how we did the fig leaf.
Yeah.
We had some fig trees outside the brewery, and my business partner, Neil, was like, how about we try like a fresh fig leaf kombucha? And when you pick fig leaves, they just smell like plants. Like they don't have any particular like flavor or aroma. But when you ferment it, the fruit flavor of the figs comes out in the leaves, and you get this like incredible complexity. So yeah, we're super stoked about that one. And it's free.
Yeah.
So it doesn't cost us anything.
Yeah, bonus.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. I really like the sound of the Douglas fir.
Mm.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it's about 3 days in now, and it's maybe 2 or 3 days in, and it's starting to come along really nicely.
So in terms of how you're selling it,
mm-hmm.
you've got your bottles,
mm-hmm.
which you sell online and with your stockists, and then you've also,
mm-hmm.
as we've kind of touched on, you sell it on tap in certain places.
Yeah.
How do they, the kind of places where you've got it on tap, how does that go, you know, are they kind of trying to sell that to the customers and
mm-hmm.
how's that going? Or are they kind of finding now that people are there for it and...
I think it's a mixture of both. It's been like a really long process to get people on board with on-draft kombucha,
mm-hmm.
especially bars, because they make such a huge profit on alcohol, on beer in particular, mm. that dedicating an entire line to a product that only a handful of people know about is quite a risk financially. So the people that have taken it on board have been places where their clientele are sort of health-focused and are already sort of clued up on what kombucha is. So Redemption Bar, for instance, in Seven Dials has our kombucha on tap. They also use it in cocktails or mocktails because it's an alcohol-free mm. space. It's at Chicken Sours. Do you know that place? They have a couple locations. They have a new
location. Rings a bell.
But they're famous for their fried chicken and their sour drinks. And so kombucha naturally fits really well with them. We have in a couple bars. There's one called Gold in Notting Hill. We have it in some co-working spaces, so like some offices. Kind of have it on tap for the people that work there, and they can kind of drink as much as they want, which is really nice.
Oh my gosh,
that's
great.
Get it in here.
Get it to the office. Yeah, we're trying to get it in as many places as we can. It's definitely a leap of faith to put a kombucha line on, but also Fugitive Motel. I don't know if you guys have heard of that place. This really cool spot that just opened in Bethnal Green. They just launched it on tap. So it's generally places where the people that have started it have had an experience with kombucha and really love it, and then they think their customers will really love it, and they really support us, and we support them. So it's sort of like, it's a really nice kind of space to test out kind of new things and find out what people like. The on-draft kombucha is a slow roll, and I think we'll start seeing more of it as time goes on.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure in 5 years it's going to be everywhere.
Yeah, it is in the States and Australia and places like that. Like, most cafes that have nitro cold brew or something like that will have a kombucha line as well.
Mm.
So it's quite common.
Yeah. Are there any kind of logistical sort of issues with like shipping and transporting quite heavy product?
Well, we got to make sure that whoever is delivering it knows, that they're fragile.
Yeah.
So, we pack them as safely as we can, and especially when we're sending them across the UK in postal cases, we have specific dividers, and we had to test drop like loads of bottles from like 20 feet up to make sure they were legit. But weight wise, it's not cheap to send a pallet of glass bottles of kombucha across the UK, but that's sort of the nature of it. And at the moment, we just sort of absorb that. But it can be risky at times, but thankfully we have kind of people that we work with now that we've been working with for a few years that we can trust with kind of glass and stuff like that.
Yeah, so not too many.
Yeah.
And are you thinking about cans, or you want to sort of stick
with
cans?
We have been experimenting with cans.
I
don't know when we'll be launching those, but I think the idea with cans is that you can reach a wider audience at a lower price point, and that's sort of the idea. So at some point we will launch them, but we don't have an exact date on that.
Yeah.
But the next thing we're going to be doing is launching a new flavor in, looks like in August, and that's the one I brought you guys today, so feel free to try that when you want. You don't have to do it now. But that's our raspberry flavor that we initially launched in Whole Foods on tap, and we got good feedback, so we thought it would be the best one to launch next. Because we've only had, three flavors for the past,
you've had
like,
your,
three
you've really
and a half
stuck
years.
With your three flavors, yeah.
Because we do everything ourselves, and everything from the brewing process to the bottling to the packaging. Like, if you look at those bottles, every single one is filled by hand, every single one is capped by hand, and then that little shrink sleeve is put on by hand. So we have a team of like six people.
Oh
yeah, it's insane. So everything we do in-house, and adding another flavor to the line has been difficult because we haven't had enough tanks to process all of that kombucha. Mm. But we just recently got a couple more, and so yeah, we're pretty stoked to finally launch a new flavor. We hope people like it. We'll see.
It sounds delicious.
Yeah,
sure,
I'm really,
really
excited for it. So initially you were kind of self-funding, sort of growing organically and like adding to your equipment as you go.
Mm-hmm.
And then you mentioned recently you've got some investment.
Yes.
Talk us through that.
We were looking for investment, but more importantly, we were looking for a partner.
Yeah.
Because we wanted to make sure that whoever we teamed up with had the same values and vision for the future as us. And we met loads of people. We met like dozens and dozens, and we had loads of meetings, and we met some great people. But nothing felt intuitively right until my business partner, Neil, got a message on LinkedIn from Duval Mortka, who who are actually a 150-year-old Belgian brewery. And they own, I think they own 11 or 12 breweries around the world. Some of the most well-respected beers in the world, like Le Chouf, Vedette, Duvel, Leafman's. I mean, these are like really old, like a lot of them are very old brands. They also own Firestone Walker and Boulevard Brewing, which are based in the States. But they'd never invested in non-alcohol. And they'd been looking to do something in that space for a while. So their CEO and his director of operations came out and visited us, and they saw a jar, they tasted it. And we developed this relationship, and discussions started happening, and we ended up partnering with them. And it felt right from the start. I think with regards to investment, for me personally, with anything, from this business to friendships to relationships to all types of stuff, I really go from my gut, no pun intended. I'm huge on the way people make you feel. And genuinely, you know intuitively when it feels right.
Mm-hmm.
And with these guys, it just felt right. They were our kind of people. Like,
yeah.
We really loved them. And it was like a real, like, real good friendship. And that was sort of what it was founded on. And so they had the same vision for Jar. Their brands are all very premium. They're high quality. They never compromise on ingredients. And they have the distribution throughout Europe. They have the production and brewing knowledge more so than we've had. They have like years of experience in laboratories and all types of stuff around Europe. So it just felt right. So we ended up teaming up with them, and the next step is to bring kombucha to mainland Europe. So that's sort of what we're aiming for next year. Well, I won't say which markets yet, but we're planning that out now. So it's really exciting.
That's really exciting. I mean, what's happening with kombucha over there? Is there a market yet, or is that really going to be you starting from scratch?
There is in some countries. Like, we're already stocked in the Netherlands, but primarily in Amsterdam,
mm-hmm.
in a place called Stash, or Stack, maybe it's pronounced, like a really high-end kind of deli. And that seems to be doing really well. So certain cities
yeah.
are really, really good for kombucha.
I bet,
like,
Berlin would take
it. Exactly.
Well.
Yeah, Berlin's got a couple of different brands doing stuff now.
Mm-hmm.
So places like Berlin, places like Amsterdam, maybe Paris. We also sell our kombucha in Bordeaux. I have a couple friends out there who distribute it for us. There's certain places where people are sort of tuned into that frequency, but there's a lot more work to do. And even in the UK, it's like, it's so difficult. I think parts of Europe are actually going to be more interested in kombucha before the rest of the UK does, because London is even just a small percentage of people here even know what kombucha is. But then you move out and you move further and you move further, and people are like, I don't even know what this is, like, you know. And
that's so true, actually. My mum lives in Birmingham, and I can think of one kombucha brand, and it's
yeah.
just like this guy who lives down the road and he sells it at the farmer's market.
Totally.
It's great.
Yeah.
But he is the only one that I've seen
yeah,
doing
for
it.
Sure.
Getting
that kind of that awareness throughout the UK, I think, is going to take 5 to 10 years,
yeah.
maybe more. I mean, it's
yeah.
it's taken 15, almost 20 years now to get the awareness throughout California and the rest of the US, and it's still like very centered around the coasts. So it's going to take a long time to kind of get that into people's consciousness, but I think the best thing to do is get it into markets where there's already an openness to that. There's a craft beer movement, or there's a wellness
yeah.
movement, and a plant-based movement, and sort of we can tap into those spaces maybe before spreading to other places, even here in the UK. But yeah, it's an exciting time, and to see the evolution of it, but it's going to take a while.
So tell us, who is Team Jar, who's working for you, and I guess it'd be interesting to know about kind of your co-founders and the roles each of you take within the business.
Yeah, I think it's really important with whoever you start a business with to make sure that you all balance each other, and that you don't double up on certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, we were really lucky that we all have different skills and different things that we love to do. So my business partners are also my best friends, which is great, also difficult at times, but ultimately really good, because there's a certain level of honesty and openness, and we're all moving towards the same goal. So our head of production and our head brewer is my best friend, Dom. And the reason Dom and I know each other is because his dad and my dad met in New Zealand in the 1970s. and became best friends. So Dom and I were like friends throughout childhood. And through Dom, I met Tom and Jess, who are brother and sister. Through them, I met Neil. And Neil is their co-founder in Crate Brewery. So Tom, Jess, and Neil own Crate. And they have a beer brewing background. And then Dom is my best friend. So Dom does all the production-based stuff. Jess sort of oversees all things Jar. She's sort of the point of contact between us and our partners, Duval. She oversees production, whereas I sit more in the marketing space, in the sort of the communication of the brand to people, because that's what I personally love to do. I like to connect with people. I like to, I don't really like sitting in an office and analyzing numbers. I really like just being out there and like sharing. And so that's sort of what makes me tick. Tom, who's Jess's brother, is kind of the finance whiz, and he's also sort of the person that mapped out the structure of how the business would kind of happen. He's kind of a visionary, and he's really brilliant at making things in his head become a reality. So he sort of pulled all the pieces together. And then Neil is sort of involved in loads of stuff, but has a lot to do with the legal aspects and some of the finance stuff as well. And he's teamed up with me for various things outward facing. But we all sort of have our own things that we focus on, but ultimately, like, the whole picture is really well balanced. And then underneath sort of all of us, we have like a bunch of like a sales team, a great sales team, a great marketing team. Our head of marketing and our head of sales both came from a craft beer background, so from AB InBev. So they sort of have this knowledge of kind of the industry as a whole, and that's really been helpful for us. Because kombucha is very similar to beer in the way that it's kind of sold and promoted and kind of marketed. So, and then we have like a great packaging team and a great kind of sales team as well. So yeah, we have probably a team of like, 10 to 12 people now. But we also share some of our sales and marketing function with Crate. So it actually allows us to not have to bear the burden of, you know, all of the cost of all these different people. So that's been really helpful for us. Yeah,
that's a really interesting collaboration, sharing team members as well. Mm-hmm. It makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
We're sort of, working towards the same thing, and we have mutual customers, and our sales team can go out and like say, hey, do you want a non-alcoholic drink? Do you want an alcoholic drink? Check both of these out.
Yeah.
So it's nice.
That person, you know, that person's going out and meeting new people and networking and making connections.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got both those heads on as well, like, oh, you might like this, or you might like this.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's really nice.
Yeah, definitely.
I think one of the things I really like about you guys and the kombucha sort of, like, brands in general is that you're very collaborative and sharing knowledge.
Mm.
So you do a lot of workshops, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, you come here today with a jar and tea and SCOBY, and everyone just seems so keen to just make kombucha known and share, share what it's all about.
Yeah.
So could we talk about, the workshops and what you do with the marketing?
Well, I think, you know, behind the workshops for me was this desire to demystify kombucha and to share how it's made with as many people as possible. We found that when we were starting the business, that there weren't a lot of kombucha breweries that wanted to share information. They're very secretive. Especially in the States, there's lots of competition, and everyone's worried about people stealing their ideas and whatnot. And from the beginning, we've been transparent about everything we do. We have like no secrets. We regularly invite people into our brewery. This is how we do it. This is literally our recipe. And the beauty of kombucha, as I mentioned previously, is that even if you use the same ingredients, you can never replicate someone's kombucha, and that's because the bacteria and yeast that you're using sort of become your own over time. They settle into the physical space that you're in. And the kind of microbiological makeup of our SCOBY will be different from anyone else's SCOBY. So the workshops are sort of a grassroots marketing campaign to spread the word about Jar as a brand, but also to get people stoked about making it, because making kombucha is super easy, it's really fun, and it's really nice when you like have created something that's making you feel good. And it also probably save you some money. Kombucha's not cheap. But it's and also it's just something I personally love doing. I, we probably do we probably probably done like 100-150 kombucha workshops over the past couple of years now.
Right.
With like, it's a lot. Yeah, we're churning these things out like every other week, you know?
Yeah.
We've educated a lot of people about kombucha, and we can offer that to different stockists. We partner up with Whole Foods and Soho House and Good and Proper Tea and Deliciously Ella. And it's a good way to partner with certain people and get the brand out there and get the brand aligned with people that we really love. It's just a lot of fun. So just getting people pumped about kombucha is really the idea behind it.
So you've got a lot of people inviting you into their space. And then do you also reach out to people and say, like, hey, we really love your brand. Like, could we collab?
Yeah, for sure. We actually at the moment are trying to do some interesting kombucha workshops, like experiential workshops, which will be not just kombucha, but all things kind of fermentation, or partnering up with interesting people to bring in different elements of the fermentation world, or the cocktail making world, or stuff like that. So basically, we're trying to move it away from just kombucha, because I think that can be, like, we've been doing that for a while, and people are interested, and our classes do really well, but we're trying to kind of broaden that a bit to get people to make more than just kombucha and do it in like weird and wonderful places. Like, I like reached out 2 days ago to the London Eye, and I was like, maybe can I do a kombucha workshop in like one of those bars? And they're like, well, the London Eye is owned by Coca-Cola, so no. I was like, it's owned by Coca-Cola?
What?
They're like, yeah, I didn't know that. That must be reasonably
new.
That's
nuts.
But yeah, if you guys have any ideas, or if anyone's listening has any weird and wonderful ideas of, you know, how to do these workshops or who to partner up with, would be great. We're always looking for
Husk and
things.
Honey would be a cool space.
Yeah,
really?
A friend of ours, Hedy, she's got this really beautiful bakery in
Spa Terminus.
We've
got like loads of, have you been down there?
No,
it's where Notorious is.
Oh,
like,
oh, cool.
But she's, yeah, it's, there's a really good space actually downstairs that we should put you in touch. That would be great for workshop.
Awesome.
Yeah, there's loads of really cool small producers around there. I'm picturing like cocktail workshops and partnering up with bars and really getting kombucha involved in like interesting ways, like rather than just
because on its own is it's one thing. It's nice to brew, it's a soft drink, but it really actually is a great cocktail mixer.
Mm.
And that you're seeing that pop up in more and more places. People want to they want to experience kombucha in a different way, and also, you know, it gets you drunk, and
what's
you'll appeal to more people.
What's a typical, like, cocktail recipe to use kombucha?
Our ginger is really good in, like, a Moscow Mule.
Mm.
My favorite, though, is a cocktail we came up with called the Salted Almond, and it's with passion fruit kombucha and orgeat syrup, which is, like, an almond syrup. It has cachaça in it. Which is like a Brazilian sugarcane liquor, which is so delicious. A little bit of fresh lime juice, like a salted rim, some cracked black pepper on top, and a little bit of agave nectar. It is banging. It is like...
I mean...
Yeah, I'm into that. I'm up for that.
Yeah. If
there's any bars listening, I want to put that on the menu.
That sounds great.
We're actually considering doing pre-mixed kegged kombucha cocktails as well, which, bars can buy, and then you just have a kombucha cocktail on tap, so... Different brands have already done that, just not necessarily with kombucha, like Hingston & Co. and places like that make really nice cocktails on tap. So we're thinking about it. We're experimenting with it.
Mm. Imagine in a few years you go into M&S and you've got your cans of G&T for the train, and next to it is like kombucha cocktail.
Pre-made M&S kombucha cocktail. But yeah, it's popping up in so many like of the mainstream supermarkets now, which is great for getting the awareness out there. I think for our product, we've had the opportunity to work with some of the bigger retailers, but because our whole process is hand done, and we do reasonably small volumes, we can't really get that volume at the moment. And also our price point is slightly higher because of the process by which we make it. So it's also probably better to get people into brands that are a little less sour and a little less complex, and so that at some point we can move into that space.
I wonder which supermarket will be the first to bring out their own
brand.
Brewery. Yeah.
Do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like the more something becomes popular and mainstream, they jump on it.
Yeah.
So
it's like non-dairy milks, I'm thinking.
Yeah, they just you're right, they've just
M&S are the kings of branding their own stuff. Like, they're very good at that. So I wouldn't be surprised if they did it at some point.
Be interesting to see. Do you have a typical week? Like, do you structure your week in a certain way?
I mean, I have quite a strict kind of personal practice every single day. Like, I get up every day and first thing meditate for 25 minutes, and that sets the tone for my day. And then I have things in the calendar, but a typical week is not normally as structured as you might think. Like, I'll check emails first thing in the morning, make a bowl of porridge, and do my thing. And then I'll either meet with different customers or meet with our marketing team and kind of go over our plans and catch up with the production team about our upcoming kind of flavors and different things we're doing. But week to week is always very different, which is great. I like spontaneity. I like not exactly knowing what's going to happen day to day and just kind of flowing with it. But of course, there's a certain level of organization to my day as well. It's not just all haphazard. You
kind of want a bit of both, don't you? Like, a little bit of structure, but then a little bit of flexibility and freedom to kind of be able to switch and, yeah.
Like, let's see, next week on Monday, I've got lunch with my friends at Plantiful. So I do a lot of lunches with, like, people in the food and drink world, and it's just a great way to keep in touch and share ideas and stuff. And then, like, trade marketing brainstorm. And then I have a meeting with Mayleaf, which is, like, an amazing tea house in Camden. And we're thinking about doing kombucha infused with really high-quality single-origin tea. So we'll do this kind of, like, kombucha tea blend that will be on tap. So we're thinking about launching something like that. And, that's just a typical day. Just a lot of kind of face-to-face meetings. And that's sort of what stimulates me and keeps me energized. So as much of that as possible, I'm super into.
Just when you mentioned that, I just remembered seeing on your Instagram, with the scobies, they keep growing layers,
yes,
and you take off sort of layers once they become too thick, right?
Yeah.
So with the baby scobies, apart from giving them away,
this to show you guys.
Someone made a belt.
Yeah.
A scoby leather belt.
We give this material to certain designers, and it's amazing. It's like, it's literally like leather.
Yeah,
it's crazy,
that's incredible.
And this is just dried.
That is dried scoby, or also, you know,
okay.
There's a difference between the scoby that we use and the scoby that is in your hand. Actually, generally speaking, that is
smells like leather.
Yeah, that's
it really does.
So it doesn't smell like vinegar anymore. But that is actually cellulose. So that is chains of glucose molecules, which is a byproduct of the fermentation that have bound together to create the structure. And we've dried it out, and when you dry out one of those kind of, called the cellulose pellicle, actually, is what we call those things. And the scoby is actually bacteria and yeast suspended in a liquid form, which is what I have in this jar right here. So that's what we use to brew the liquid. But that's a byproduct, and we sometimes leave it, and then we dry it out, and then those kind of cellulose structures, like, go quite, they kind of bind together.
Like, mesh together, sort of thing.
Yeah, and it becomes waterproof, it...
This is the future.
It's super
cool. I saw it on there. I was like, oh my gosh, that's the future.
It's fully sustainable
plant
with vegan leather, basically. And you can dye it, you can treat it, you can thicken it, you can do
it. Is this dyed? Or this is...
We dyed this with just some blue dye. If you look at it, like, if you hold it up to the window, you can sort of... I don't know if you can see through that thing. See how, like, look at the structure of it. It's so cool. It's like these fibers and, like...
That is so cool.
So there's definitely there's a brand in San Francisco that makes clothing out of scoby leather. It looks kind of weird. It looks kind of like skin. And I'm like, I'm not sure about that. If you dye it correctly, it can look really nice. But
but I think for accessories.
It's like mummified skin. Or
yeah.
The
purse. Yeah.
And we had a friend make a coin purse out of it. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a lot you can do with it.
That is the future.
We don't have the time, but
if someone was able to create their own brand and take byproducts from you, I feel like that would work.
Yeah, for sure.
If anyone's listening.
Yeah. Well, I mean, any kind of designers that are interested in this kind of stuff, give us a shout. This was made by, or not this one, but the belt that was made recently with this stuff was made by a designer called Polly Redfern, who had an exhibition at Somerset House, and she requested some and then made this awesome belt out of it. So
cool.
There's loads of stuff you can do with it.
It's amazing. So to finish up, can you tell us what you consider to be your greatest achievement in Jar?
Oh, man. I think the Harrods thing, which I touched on, for me personally, that was, like, huge. And it was quite an emotional moment for me. But Whole Foods as well was quite a big one. But surreal every time, like, you remind yourself that, I don't know, for like, I never thought this is what I'd be doing with my life. And I don't think this is what my business partners thought they would be doing with their lives. So sometimes we just check ourselves and are like, guys, this is nuts. So we're like, we've actually been able to create something that we love and do it together with people that we love. And I think just like constantly reminding yourself of how crazy this is and how like grateful you feel for it. So like gratitude for me is a really important thing, and having that as kind of a daily practice. But yeah, I think just making a kombucha that doesn't taste bad is a big one. I mean, because our kombucha tasted so bad for so long. And I remember, like, when we ferment it, and we do regular kind of tasting panels. We tasted the batch, and everyone was, we nailed it. We finally got it. But it's a constant process, and we're always working on improving our recipe. But yeah, to one day taste the thing that you've been making for so long and realize that, well, this actually tastes good. Just convincing yourself that one day it will taste as you want it to taste, and then finally it does. So yeah, I guess those are some of the biggest achievements.
Yeah, that's pretty special. So in terms of the rest of the year, new flavor launching in August.
Yeah.
So that's in the regular size bottles as well.
That's going to be the regular size. The small ones, and then the slightly bigger ones too.
And then what's the rest of your year looking like so far?
Sort of planning probably for next year, which is hopefully expansion into Europe, and developing sort of a marketing campaign for the first time, which will be sort of a flavor-led campaign to educate people about what kombucha actually tastes like, because it's difficult to describe to people. So, you know, you can visually see kombucha on the shelves and stuff, but we're trying to articulate the concept of how it makes you feel, how our brand makes you feel. And so developing that strategy and developing further partnerships and finding interesting places and weird and wonderful kind of partnerships to do workshops with. And just spreading the word as much as we can and continuing to try and differentiate ourselves from all the other brands out there. That's sort of what the year looks like.
Cool.
Great. And where can people find you?
You can find us at Whole Foods and Planet Organic, Selfridges, Harrods, Harvey Nichols, on Amazon. We're hopefully going to be on Amazon Prime nationally reasonably soon, so keep your eyes peeled for that. You can also buy kombucha directly from our website. And we have upcoming workshops. We always have upcoming workshops, but look on Eventbrite. We do stuff with Whole Foods and Source Market Good and Proper Tea. So we're always doing those if you guys want to meet us in person and make your own booch and have a chat. And if you do come to one of our workshops, I become your personal kombucha consultant, which is like something I actually offer, which is getting a bit out of hand now because we've done so many. But
yeah,
because I run the Instagram.
You get all these photos.
I run the Instagram. So like at the end of every class, I'm like, so follow us on Instagram and you can send me like questions or photos. So because we've done so many of them, they're a lot now, but it's kind of nice because I think it's difficult once you start brewing when you encounter different issues to figure that out. Follow us on Instagram and feel free to reach out even if you haven't come to a kombucha workshop. I'll help you out with your home brewing.
Amazing. And what's your Instagram handle?
It's just at Jar Kombucha, JARR Kombucha.
Great.
You can find us on Instagram at What's Cooking Podcast, Twitter at What's Cooking Pod, and email thewhatscookingpodcast@gmail.com.
If you liked this episode, please do subscribe and give us a 5-star rating. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.